This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A. We're taking a break for a few weeks in August, and we'd like to use this opportunity to introduce you to some of C-SPAN's other podcasts. BookNotes Plus offers listeners nonfiction books and authors with C-SPAN's Brian Lamb. We've selected a conversation with historian Eleanor Herman, who sat down to talk about her book on presidential sex scandals, appropriately titled Sex with Presidents.
Eleanor Herman writes books about sex. Sex with kings, sex with the queen, and recently, sex with presidents. U.S. presidents. However, out of the 45 men who have been president of the United States, only 9 get special attention from Ms. Herman in her book published in 2020. She talked about a few of those presidents in our conversation. Eleanor Herman, your book, Sex with Presidents, has this quote that LBJ was the last U.S. president whose blatant marital infidelities would be concealed by the press. What was the significance of that?
Well, it was very significant because the public for many years had no idea that the presidents did have extramarital affairs. It actually started off in the late 17 and throughout the 1800s, that the press was very muckraking the way they are now. And that's how come we know about Alexander Hamilton's affair with a blackmailing prostitute. We know about Thomas Jefferson's relationship with his enslaved woman. We know about Grover Cleveland's rape and impregnating a young woman because the press covered it. And then around 1900, everything sort of changed, and journalism went from being a kind of trade, a rather lowly thing to do, to being a respected career. Journalists became gentlemen, and gentlemen didn't report on other gentlemen's love affairs. The National Press Club got started and had its own code of ethics. So even though journalists in D.C. were well aware of Woodrow Wilson's love affairs, Warren Harding's hundreds of women, FDR, JFK, LBJ, they just didn't report it. And then what happened was Watergate. And suddenly the presidency was no longer to be respected and protected. It was to be investigated. And that's what we've had since then.
In reading your book, I noticed that you special focus on about 9 of the 45 men that have been president. But the president that got the most pages was FDR, 32 pages. Why?
Oh, you sat there and counted. My goodness.
Yeah. Why did he get the most attention by one page? Warren Harding was 31.
And JFK probably had the most women. He and Warren would have been vying for the top prize. FDR was a fascinating character. His marriage to Eleanor was fascinating. She was a very interesting woman. She had an affair of her own with a woman. He did so much for the country in terms of bringing it out of the Depression and through World War II almost to the bitter end. I imagine that he got the most pages because just the whole story was very compelling.
So what was the most important part of it that we as citizens, of course, I was alive back then, but not conscious. What is it that the public didn't know about him when he was president for most of the 4 terms?
Well, they didn't know a couple of things. For one thing, they didn't know that he was totally paralyzed in his legs. He fashioned for himself braces that he wore under his suit pants. And if he was leaning on someone, often his older son, he could kind of roll his legs forward from the hips, and it looked like he was lame. The American public knew that he had had polio, and there was some lameness there, but they didn't know that he was truly wheelchair-bound. At the time, handicapped people were not elected for public office. You know, the public thought you would be unfit for anything just because your legs didn't move. So he kept that quite secret, and the press... there again, they respected his wishes, and there were no photographs published of him in his wheelchair. The other thing the public didn't know was that he and Eleanor really didn't have much of a marriage anymore. They hadn't had sex since World War I, and he had a lifetime love affair with Eleanor's former social secretary, the lovely Lucy Mercer. And then he also was having an affair with his White House secretary, Missy LeHand, who would wander into his bedroom at night saying she was there to take dictation, but the household staff couldn't help but notice she had no steno pad in hand. So there was much about him that Americans did not know.
You called Grover Cleveland a rapist.
Yes, I think that is clear what happened. When he was sheriff of Buffalo, he had been interested in a 33-year-old widow, a beautiful woman, and he apparently raped her one night, impregnated her, and then took the baby away from her and put her into an insane asylum. I imagine it was so that no one would ever believe her story.
How'd he get elected president with that in his background?
Well, 10 years later, he had been a very successful mayor of Buffalo and governor of the state of New York, and there's something there that doesn't quite make sense to me. He was so totally incorrupt. You know, he battled Tammany Hall and all of these corrupt people who were stealing from the taxpayer and enriching themselves. And he had a reputation for being extraordinarily honest. And, you know, perhaps this rape was something that was totally out of his character. I'm not quite sure what happened. But when he was nominated as the Democratic candidate, in 1884, the story comes out about what he had done to this poor woman, Maria Halpin. And, you know, people who were supporters of Cleveland said she was a prostitute, a whore. She was sleeping with all these men. They tried to blame it on his deceased friend. And finally, she came out and she told the whole story. I mean, she'd been leading a very quiet life, and this was the last thing she wanted. And oddly, Cleveland never denied it. He actually said that she, you know, she was not a whore. She had not been sleeping with his friend. He took responsibility for this child, made sure it had a good home. So there, when all of this hit the press, the question was, how would Americans vote? This was the height of the Victorian era. So would they vote for the rapist who was going to save the taxpayers money, or would they vote for his opponent, the Republican candidate James Blaine, who was a faithful husband and good family man who had over various years robbed the country blind in a series of corrupt deals. And bear in mind that the women were not allowed to vote in 1884, which probably would have changed the results. But I think most voters chose Cleveland because he had been an honest public official, and they didn't seem to care too much for the allegations of rape.
What was your book, Sex with Kings, about?
That was my first book, and that was a fun one, too. It examined the lives of royal European mistresses in the centuries, we're talking 15, 16, 1700s, where women who were bright, had certain political skills, wanted to earn a good living for themselves, really had no path to do that unless they slept with the king. So it was a kind of constant beauty contest at court. Who is going to replace the king's official mistress and become the duchess and have political power and, you know, earn all this money? So that was an awful lot of fun.
How about Sex with the Queen? And which queen was it?
Oh, there were quite a few queens who had love affairs. And in some of the cases, the kings didn't particularly care if, for instance, they already had a couple of children with the queen. And, you know, some of the kings were gay, or they were very much in love with their mistresses. There was a gay king of Sweden, Gustavus Adolphus, in the late 1700s, who apparently couldn't have sex with a woman. He found it so disgusting. So he was very glad. He actually encouraged his wife to have an affair with a general, and she popped out two boys, and, you know, the kingdom was safe from rebellion. So I always like looking at the women's stories, because I feel that women are often neglected in the telling of history, which is often written by men, about men, for men to read.
Back to our U.S. presidents. As I said earlier, 31 pages devoted to Warren Harding. How many children did he have out of wedlock with his mistresses?
There are reports of a couple early in his marriage to Florence in the 1890s. The one that got the most press, however, was with a young woman named Nan Britton. She was about 20 when their affair began. She'd had a crush on him back in Ohio. They lived on the same street when she was 12 years old, and he was 30 years older. So he was a U.S. senator, and she asked him to help her find a job. Her father had died, and Harding had been friends with the father, so he found her a job, and they had an affair, and they're making love in his office in the Capitol, and she gets pregnant, and he supports her, sort of handing her money, and then he drops dead in 1923. Nan went to the family and said, "Look, I have this baby. It's Harding's daughter. I can't support her. Can you help me financially?" And they said, "Absolutely not. It's not his child. You've probably been sleeping around." And so Nan goes out and self-publishes a book called The President's Daughter. It came out in 1927. It was a bestseller. And she made a fortune, and that's how she was able to support her daughter. And then the latest story is, about 5 years ago, there was a DNA test done on Nan's grandson and Warren Harding's great-nephew, and it matched. So clearly the child was Harding's.
You also talk about the affair, long-term affair, with Carrie Phillips back in Marion, Ohio. But the point that I wanted to ask you about was that he apparently started having an affair with her when his wife was in the hospital with kidney problems.
Yeah. Warren couldn't help himself. He actually told the National Press Club that it's a good thing he wasn't a woman, because he'd be always pregnant. He just couldn't say no to sex. And he was actually a nice guy. He was honest. He wasn't corrupt. He just wanted everybody to be happy, but he couldn't turn down women. And there was something about Warren Harding, I don't know if it was pheromones or what, but women would follow him around like howling cats in heat. And these weren't, women of light repute. They were society hostesses, respectable married women, teenagers. Everybody wanted to have sex with Warren Harding, and he usually complied.
You say in your book that John F. Kennedy was a three-whore-a-day. He had a three-whore-a-day habit. Explain that one.
I think there was something wrong with him, either physiologically, psychologically. He just would drop his trousers and have sex with several different women a day. He seemed to truly need it. When he was campaigning, his advisors had women lined up when the plane would land, and there'd be 3, 4, 5 hookers standing there, and JFK would pick. Usually he'd pick two of them. And as Angie Dickinson, the actress, reportedly said about him, he wasn't very good in bed. It was the best 60 seconds of her life, she said, having sex with JFK. So, yeah, and he had these women in the White House. Jackie knew about it, and she would take the kids and leave very often. She had a place in the Hunt Country in Virginia she retired to. And these women would show up at the White House for sex with the president. It was dangerous because the Secret Service couldn't vet them. You know, they didn't know what they were going to be doing up there. Maybe they could kill the president. The weird thing about it was that JFK would not instruct the White House staff to change the sheets once he was finished. And he would always have sex with these women, not in his bedroom suite, but in his wife's. So they would have to pick hairs and bobby pins off of Jackie's sheets. And one night, she goes into bed, reaches under the pillow, and pulls out a pair of women's panties. And she looks at her husband and says, "Would you please shop these around? They're not my size."
You name lots of people in that chapter. Angie Dickinson, as you said, Judith Campbell Exner, Marilyn Monroe, Mimi Beardsley, Marlena Dietrich, Jane Mansfield, Pamela Turner, and Mary Meyer. There's a story behind all of those. But why, after all the years, did Mimi Beardsley write her book a couple of years ago and be so precise about her relationship at age 18 with the president?
I'm not certain why she waited so long. Most of these stories tumbled out after Watergate, when suddenly it was okay to discuss the seamier side of a president's life. Judith Campbell Exner wrote her autobiography, and many others. And Mimi waited. Maybe she just wanted to get the story out while she still could. Her story is a very tragic one, I think. She was a fresh-faced 18-year-old intern in the White House press office in 1962, and the president invited her up to the private residence in the White House for drinks with some of the other staff. And then he asked her, "Would you like me to give you a tour of the rooms?" And she was just so starstruck, she said, "Sure." So he takes her into Jackie's bedroom, pushes her down on the bed, and has sex with her. And she didn't call it rape in her book because she said she didn't try to stop it, but she was just so shocked. Here was the most powerful man in the world doing this to her. She didn't make a move to stop it, but she did. He sent her home in a cab, and she went home sort of sad that she wouldn't be a virgin on her wedding night. Anyway, it was the beginning of an affair, and it lasted about a year.
Why did the media not cover any of his dalliances?
They were just instructed not to. The reporters, you know, they would see things. You know, they saw him in a hotel room with Angie Dickinson. I think Angie was on the bed. They saw Marilyn Monroe being escorted by the Secret Service up to a suite in New York. And a lot of times the reporters said, "Look, you know, let's break the story." And the editor said, "Absolutely not." It was still pre-Watergate. I think that kind of thing was frowned upon. It was also the Cold War. It might have been looked upon as a kind of treason to publish something like that with, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Berlin Wall and everything going on, that they didn't want to tarnish the reputation of the U.S. president at that time.
You write that Jack Kennedy's reputation started to crack in 1975 when they had the CIA investigative hearings with Frank Church of Idaho. Looking into, among other things, Sam Giancana and his, you know, whether or not he was the fellow who tried to assassinate Fidel Castro. give us the background on that and his girlfriend, Judith Campbell Exner.
Yes, so JFK had an affair for a couple of years, though the timeline is disputed, with a beautiful woman named Judith Campbell, later Judith Campbell Exner. And she had black hair and bright blue eyes. She looked a little bit like Elizabeth Taylor, a gorgeous figure. And she was simultaneously the mistress of Sam Giancana, who was the Chicago mob boss who had taken over from Al Capone. So there was clearly danger of blackmail. And J. Edgar Hoover, the longtime FBI director, told JFK that he really has to stop seeing Judith, but apparently he did not. She claims they continued the affair another 9 or 10 months once JFK learned of her relationship with Giancana. But it's, you know, it's typical of these guys who have something called hubris syndrome, which is a psychological disorder that manifests when someone suddenly has great power. They become reckless, restless, they don't listen to anybody, and they often end up shooting themselves in the foot.
You actually break it down into four categories about why men who seek higher office suffer from these syndromes, including, as you said, the hubris syndrome, bipolar disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, and then a superfluity of testosterone. Why is it that some people who seek these offices have all of those things, or some of them?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a certain personality who thinks he would make an outstanding president of the United States and actually want that job. In my mind, I feel like you have to be sort of crazy to even think that and go for it, right? Like, who would want that? So I think that the same compulsions, the ego, the narcissism that send a man hurtling after the White House would also send him hurtling into the arms of a woman not his wife. I think there's a connection there.
How did you know when to trust the sources for your book?
Oh, well, if you read just about everything you can get your hands on and then you kind of sit back and think about it, I think historians can make a call. You know, what makes sense, really?
Richard Nixon, a mistress?
Apparently there is a story that he had a Hong Kong cocktail hostess as a mistress, and he ended up getting her U.S. citizenship. Whatever his relationship with her, the FBI was concerned. This was before he was president. But they were concerned enough to try to intervene and stop it. But that's the only story I found about Richard Nixon.
Did I read in your book that Roger Stone might have been responsible for reporting that in one of his books?
Oh, I don't think so.
I saw a reference to it somewhere. It may not have been in your book.
Okay.
Why write about sex and all these different leaders in the world? Where did you get the interest in doing this?
Well, you know, some of my readers have asked me, am I a sex maniac? Because I've done sex with kings and sex with the queen and sex with presidents. And I don't think I'm a sex maniac, but I'm just interested in human nature, Brian, and I'd like to know why people do the things they do, why they think it's a good idea often to do something that's just going against, you know, everything they should be doing in their own self-interests. And I have found that there are various lenses I can look through to examine human nature. One of them is sex, another is power. The confluence of the two is often very interesting because it seems to heat everything up. It rises to a rapid boil. You know, it's much more interesting when you're the king having these issues or you're the president. And I also think the word sex in a book title is fun and probably will get some interest.
What impact did it have on you that the book came out during COVID?
The impact was that I didn't get to do any speaking engagements or go to any TV studios or all of the fun things I normally do when a book comes out, you know, and do book signings. I love so much meeting my readers and, you know, posing for pictures with them and signing their books and shaking their hands. And I didn't get to do that this time. So, you know, my butt has been in the same chair it's been in the past couple of years doing Zoom book events. And they were fun. One thing I like about them is that a lot of people who ordinarily couldn't have seen me at a real event in a bookstore were able to, you know, to tune into Zoom. So I had some really good audiences. But I do miss being on the circuit. And I hope for my next book, which won't be coming out for a year and a half, that you know, I'll be back meeting people in person.
How does it all during this time affect sales?
Oh, from what I understand, publishers are doing very well. People are reading more than ever. They're doing audiobooks when they are walking. You know, they can't, since we can't run around as much as we used to, there's actually more time for reading. And as they said, more and more people are going to Zoom book events. They were telling me events which normally might get, you know, 200 people in a physical room, suddenly they're getting 1,000 people, 2,000 people, you know, watching on YouTube or on Zoom. So I think it's actually and surprisingly going quite well for the publishing industry.
You devote 17 pages to Gary Hart. He wasn't a president. How did he get in your book?
Well, he had a sex scandal that was very important for presidents, and he was a presidential hopeful. He was seen as going to be the Democratic candidate in 1988. He had a great reputation and a wonderful career, and he was Kennedy handsome and well-spoken and charming. And so he just shot himself in the foot with a model named Donna Rice. And this was after he had told reporters who had been asking about, you know, some allegations of adulterous affairs, well, you know, if it's not true, why don't you just follow me around? These are lies. And you know, then they followed him around, and they did find that he was indeed entertaining a blonde. And I think also it was a lesson for how not to handle it, because he just denied it. Like, there's all of the facts there, you know, and it's clear that he was spending the weekend in his townhouse with Donna Rice, and he just denied it. I imagine he felt it was nobody's business, so he was perfectly justified in lying about it. But the American people did not like being lied to. Surveys at the time said they don't really care about his affair, but they really didn't like his lying and his, you know, pontificating about it. So there was another young and hopeful politician named Bill Clinton who was also going to run in 1988. And when he saw what happened to Gary Hart, he realized he better withdraw from the race and clean up his act, get a statement prepared for how he's going to deal with the same issue, and run in 1992.
As you know, during Bill Clinton's run for the presidency, there was a lot of publicity about his association with many different women. He won, and he won again. Why didn't? And he was impeached, and none of this seemed to have any impact. So I just ask you a broader question. Does any of this matter to the public about sex with presidents? And why did Bill Clinton leave you know, the presidency very popular?
It's an interesting question, and it's one that took me back all the way to Alexander Hamilton, the first U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. That was the first U.S. political sex scandal, so I covered that, though he, too, was not a president. And when it came out that he'd been having an affair with this blackmailing prostitute, and there were also allegations of financial corruption, he wrote a 100-page pamphlet explaining everything. Yes, he'd been sexually unfaithful. No, he was not financially corrupt. When you look at Grover Cleveland, he never denied that he had raped this woman. I think that it's the American people really have never cared that much about politicians' sex lives. They really hadn't. And they still don't. They didn't like Gary Hart so much, I think, because of the way he handled it. If he had just admitted it, said he needs to work on his marriage, apologized to his wife and the American people, I frankly think he could have run. And you're right, people didn't care about Bill Clinton. They didn't even care about Donald Trump and the allegations of rape and walking into the beauty pageant changing room to see 15-year-olds changing into their swimsuits and really creepy things like that, right? I think Trump supporters care more about immigration and abortion and other things that are more important to them.
Which wife of the presidents you wrote about and their affairs cared about their husbands having these relationships?
I imagine they all did, Brian. You know, it must be hurtful. I know that Florence Harding tried to physically keep him in the White House. She shocked the staff, many of whom wrote their own autobiographies after Watergate, you know, recalling all of these stories. She'd be standing on the White House stairs in the main atrium and say, "Warren, you're not leaving this White House tonight." And he would run out the front door with his Secret Service agent into a car and go to a house of ill repute. I know it really hurt her. And it also really hurt Jackie Kennedy. You know, she was so depressed. She ended up getting on prescription drugs, Valium, and different things like that, just to try to numb the pain.
You suggest that Jackie Kennedy either had an affair or relationship with Gianni Agnelli, the Fiat man, the Italian, and also before she married him, Onassis.
Yes, that is the story about Gianni Agnelli. And I think it's pretty clear that she did have one with Onassis, which I'd never heard of until I went into this research. But Onassis had been dating her sister, and she goes on this Mediterranean cruise with them, and she ends up having a relationship with Onassis, who bought her a ruby necklace worth, I think, something like $600,000 in today's money. And this got into the press, and people were actually protesting, "Where is our first lady? She needs to be here." And finally, JFK prevailed upon her to come home. I think she would periodically do things like this, not show up at White House events. Mrs. Johnson, Lady Bird, often filled in for Jackie, because I think it was a form of a protest about, you know, her husband's three-whore-a-day habit.
Mamie Eisenhower and her husband had to deal with somebody named Kay Summersby. How much did she know about Kay Summersby, and what was her reaction?
So the background to this story is when Dwight Eisenhower was one of the top generals in Europe during World War II. He was first based in London. And he had a London driver. They had taken down all of the street signs in case the Nazis landed, they would get lost. So they needed drivers who knew every single street in London. And Kay was a lovely 33-year-old divorcee, and she soon became more than just his driver. She became an aide, a secretary. They were photographed in Time magazine and all of these different publications, and Mamie's back in D.C., and she sees this lovely young woman always with her husband. So she was aware of it, and she was distressed, and there were some letters back and forth. At the time, Kay was engaged to an American Army officer. And that's what Dwight told Mamie. "Look, she's going to be married soon." But then the Army officer stepped on a landmine and blew himself to bits. And it was at that point that Eisenhower and Kay Summersby realized that they had actually been in love all this time. They were working together 18 hours a day to try to save the world from the evils of Nazi Germany. So it's not surprising. And they actually, according to Kay, and I have no reason to disbelieve her, they tried to have sex twice, but he was unable to achieve an erection, and that was the end of that.
You say that in the FDR White House, Mrs. Roosevelt was having affairs.
Yes. You know, she and FDR were very ill-suited. They should never have gotten married in hindsight. She did not like sex, at least not with men. And she was a very serious person, and as time went on, she became less and less feminine. And FDR just wanted, you know, a very feminine, frilly, smiling, feminine woman. And so he began having an affair with his wife's social secretary, and Lucy Mercer Rutherford would actually be with him at the when he had his fatal stroke in 1945. So it was a lifelong love affair. Eleanor, for her part, you know, she went out and forged her own remarkable path in life. And along the way, she did have an affair with a top journalist from the Associated Press named Lorena Hickok, called Hick. And it lasted maybe a couple of years, and then Eleanor just was so busy at First Lady, taking on so many roles and helping so many others, that it ended. But they always stayed very close, and Eleanor made sure that Hick was always taken care of the rest of her life.
So who were the presidents that had no scandal whatsoever, no mistresses that anybody knows about? We don't talk much about that, but you must know.
Well, you know, the paperback of Sex with Presidents is coming out in September, and HarperCollins has this thing where there's bonus material in the back. It's called the PS section, and it's fun because the author can write whatever they want. So I was trying to decide, what am I going to write about? You know, 2 years researching adultery and rape and lies, it really had taken a bit of an emotional toll on me. So I decided I would write about the happiest presidential marriages. So the Bidens, clearly, the Obamas, the Carters. There's a funny story about the Trumans. He became president when FDR died in 1945. So he and his wife were in their early 60s. They move into the White House, and one morning, Bess Truman, the First Lady, has to shamefacedly tell the chief usher that he needs to replace the slats under their bed. They had broken them.
What about John Adams, George W. Bush, James Polk?
I read
Abe Lincoln.
About the John and Abigail Adams, absolutely. Also the Grants. You know, Ulysses S. Grant was this handsome, rugged guy, and he married this woman who was cross-eyed and just not attractive physically, but she had this warmth, this kindness and radiance. And when he became president, she wanted to get an operation to uncross her eyes, which is frightening when you think about doing that in in the 1860s. And the doctor told her it was too late, and she was so upset. And her husband said, "Julia, I love you so much just the way you are. Why would you think of having this operation on your eyes?" And she said, "I don't want to embarrass you. I wish I just looked prettier the way other women do." And he said, "Julia, don't even think about it. These are the eyes that I fell in love with. And if you got them uncrossed, I might not love them half so well." So that was a beautiful love story. But for reasons of space, I couldn't go through every single presidential marriage and write about it.
What's your next book going to be about?
I'm having a load of fun with that, Brian. It's called Off With Her Head, 3,000 Years of Demonizing Women in Politics. And the idea for this book came to me a couple of years ago. I was reading a wonderful 2010 biography of Cleopatra and how the Romans systematically destroyed her reputation. And many of the things that they did were very reminiscent of what happened with Hillary Clinton in 2016. And I thought, wait, how could there be similarities? And then I looked back at other women throughout history And it's almost like, I call it the misogynist handbook. There are steps and rules and measures to take to bring women down. They're too ambitious, their voices are shrill, they're sexually depraved, they're unlikable, and each one of these issues is a chapter. So I'm having a load of fun writing that.
Our guest, Eleanor Herman, wrote a number of books on sex, the latest one, Sex with Presidents. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, you can find Book Notes Plus and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And remember, Q&A will be right back here with new episodes in September.